I'm absolutely delighted to welcome our next speaker, someone I read every week in The Guardian. I'm sure you're all very familiar with Oliver James's work. So welcome.
I hope I'm going to be more Leonard Cohen than Lady Gaga, but... And I'm very struck by, I think Jim's introduction was extremely evocative, made me think of all sorts of things. It made me remember, for instance, you go back to Masson and his revelations about Freud and so on, and the way that Freud changed his mind about whether sexual abuse was a problem, and how you could totally understand why he did, in a way, because, you know, in 1895 in Vienna, to say that there was an epidemic of sexual abuse, I mean, it didn't go down exactly very well when Esther Ranson said it in the 1980s. And I remember what Jim's comments reminded me of was working at the Castle Hospital in Richmond, as I did as a clinical psychologist. And I used to do IQ tests, and there was a five-year-old girl I was testing who was coming out with, and I was fairly naive in those days, but I mean, she was coming out with some stuff that I just couldn't believe a five-year-old girl would be saying things like that, and really, you know, behaving in a pretty sexualized fashion. And I remember taking this to my supervisor, who was an Anna Freud Center trained conventional psychoanalyst, and saying, you know, surely this is an indication of something funny going on. I mean, you know, how on earth could a five-year-old girl know about this, that, and the other type of sexual activity? And she said to me, God heavens, what do you think? Of course, she's a five-year-old girl, you're a man, of course, what do you expect? I mean, absolutely astonishing. You know, that was the psychoanalytic belief, and it was widely held that it was perfectly normal for five-year-old girls to, you know, have very explicit sexual ideas about men. So it really took Esther Ranson, we have to actually give her, however annoying she may be in person, I've had some experience of her in person, but, you know, we have to take, you know, it's a great example Jim's got there, actually. It's something that was, it really wasn't, even in supposedly enlightened place like the Castle Hospital, they really didn't regard sexual abuse as being a serious issue. But that's a good place for us to start today, I think, is to think about the considerable evidence now that a woman who was sexually abused in childhood, on average, will have about 5% less of the hippocampal region of the brain and of probably the amygdala part of the brain as well. And that social and psychological environments, psychosocial environments, have a significant effect on not just the pattern of neurotransmitters we have and the pattern of brain waves, but actually on the size of bits of brain. And that is why it is meaningful for Jim to encourage us all to come here together today and ask ourselves whether the marketing society that we live in today is actually a form of abuse, that it actually also has an effect, not just on the thoughts and feelings, it's in the end, that's where it's manifested, of children, and as they grow up then into teenagers and then adults, but and on, of course, on all of us, but actually a direct effect on the brain chemistry. And there is, of course, as I'm sure all of you are more or less aware, you know, real evidence for this. And I would recommend Eric Sigmund's book, for example, Remote Controlled, on the impact of television, for example. Television has a very direct, just the hours that you watch combined with what kind of programs you watch. If you watch the commercial channels, they have much more edits in them, much quicker cuts. They affect attention deficit. They have an effect on the brain. And there's a cumulative effect, which is going to be going on over the course of your childhood and over the course of your teenage years and on. There's one proviso I would make about today's event, and that is that we do have to, of course, be very wary, especially if you're as antique as I am, of getting into this kind of young people today, you know. We don't want to be standing around demonising children, or, you know, sitting here with our in my case 60s values, saying God, isn't it disgusting? You know, they're not basically doing what all generations do, saying, well, aren't they more like us? We do have to try and be selective about this and precise about it. But I think that we're not just kind of the equivalent of disgusted of Tunbridge Wells, only disgusted of Stoke Newington or Islington. I think what we are doing here today is a serious matter. And obviously, I think it's my job in the time I have to try and sort of set the broader context for the problem we're discussing. As some of you may know, I have done my best to try and popularise the work of Tim Kasser and Richard Ryan and others in America, showing that people who place too high a value on money, possessions, appearances, physical appearance, but also keeping up with the Joneses kind of appearances, and fame, people who place too high a value on one or all of those things, are at greater risk, statistically significantly, of suffering from the commonest kinds of mental illness, depression, anxiety, substance abuse, and personality disorders. It's a very important literature, I think. It's well established. It's not a sort of dodgy literature, if you like. It's properly done by good scientists. I think it does prove that materialist values are an independent variable in causing mental illness. They are a really significant contributory factor to mental illness. and in terms of the bigger picture that I've tried to paint, jumping off from there, when you look at the World Health Organization, again, reliable evidence of the amounts of mental illness in different countries around the world, you find that there is a very clear relationship between the degree of materialism of a nation and the amount of mental illness in its population, a dramatic difference. So the clearest one that I've tried to highlight is the distinction between mainland Western Europe, which is a good deal less materialistic than the English-speaking nations, particularly America, which in the WHO study comes out as easily the most bonkers world country in the world. Surprise, surprise. 26.4% having suffered a mental illness in the last 12 months. We come out as 23% of us having suffered a mental illness in the last 12 months. The average for English-speaking nations, UK, USA, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, is 23%. And by a happy coincidence, the average for the 6 mainland Western European nations measured in the WHO study is exactly half that, is 11.5%. And if the French weren't quite so nutty, because unfortunately 18% of them suffered a mental illness in the last 12 months, but if you took the French out of the equation, it would be much lower, but it's actually 11.5%, the average for mainland Western Europe. And I maintain that the explanation for that huge difference, I mean, you know, the simple obvious implication of that is just be more like mainland Western Europe, in particular Denmark, and you can slash the amount of mental illness in this country by half within however many generations it takes to become more like Denmark. The explanation that I offer for that is I don't want to go into that in too much length today because that's not really the main subject, but it's the backdrop to the discussion, is what I call a distinction between selfish and unselfish capitalism. And the kind of capitalism that we've had for the last 30 years is incredibly toxic. And, of course, as Jim points to the budget yesterday, where we really saw what was really happening, that you know, we've had Thatcherism, we had Blatcherism, and now we've got Catcherism, in which you've got to rob, you know, it's a continuation of robbing the poor and the middle income people to give to the rich. There was no trickle down effect, of course not. And the whole argument obviously overlaps with Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett's arguments about inequality. But my argument is that you have to look at the fundamentals, which is the form of political economy. And what we've had is a form of political economy, Thatcherism, selfish capitalism, call it what you will, free market economics, which gives people very insecure employment, which very much is based around short-term share price, which is then used by chief executives as the excuse for paying themselves ludicrous multiples of the average pay of the workforce, and so on and so forth. I don't want to bang on about that because you probably already know the sort of arguments I'm talking about. The point is that as a result of selfish capitalism, we have twice as much mental illness as in mainland Western Europe. And as we've seen from good work by Colin Shaw and people at the Institute of Psychiatry looking at trends in mental illness, a doubling of the amount of mental illness amongst young people since Thatcherism, since 1980. Good evidence published in the JCCP. We've become, put it in a very simple way, a nation of shop till you drop, it could be you, credit-fueled consumer junkies. That's the wider society that our children are growing up in. Those are the values that are being transmitted down from parent to child. Those are the values, of course, that we're mainly concerned with today, that the corporations, through advertisers, are passing down. And there is absolutely direct evidence that the amount of materialism, by the by, this isn't just adults I'm talking about, that what I call the affluenza virus or materialism, if it is more prevalent in children, those children are at greater risk of suffering from childhood mental illnesses. There's good American evidence for that. And the key point, therefore, with advertising is that it has been four times more spent per capita on advertising to the American population for at least 30 or 40 years than is spent per capita in mainland Western Europe. In much of mainland Western Europe, they don't even have shops open on a Sunday. An awful lot of the shops aren't open. There is a totally different attitude to consumption there compared with America. And if you look in the rest of the English-speaking world, including us, twice as much spent on advertising. And really that is the key statistic to have in the back of your mind today. That is the absolute core of the matter. The sheer quantity of money that is spent at trying to persuade you that things that you don't really need are real needs. That's what the purpose of advertising is to conflate real needs with wants. The impact of advertising and of is directly on values. Is on your priorities. Is on what. Yes, it's specific. If it's very effective advertising, it's specific on actually making Jim's daughter want to have a Madonna album. But it's a much more insidious matter in that it's going on all over the place all the time. And it's affecting your values. It's turning you from somebody who is what is technically called intrinsically motivated, which is where nearly all children start off. If you think of your children, I think of my 10-year-old and 7-year-old, and I think of how from as young as you can remember, they are the joy they get of playing with their teddy, the engagement, which God knows I wish I still had to the same degree, that we all sadly lose to far too great an extent, but the more that we can regain it, the better, the more we can move back to that state of emotional health in which most of us start our lives. It moves you away from being intrinsically motivated, in which you can play for hours quite happily, even at Christmas time. Usually with my mother always used to love the fact that when you give small children a present, usually they play with the packaging that it came in for much longer than they actually play with the piece of plastic crap that they were given instead. and this key distinction between intrinsic motivation and goals and extrinsic motivation and goals, extrinsic being directed towards reward and praise, is what is the cumulative effect of advertising and marketing, is to shift you, is to help shift you from being intrinsically motivated to extrinsically motivated. And the simplest study, there are many that I give in examples in my books, but I think the simplest one is the one where they just got a whole lot of students to play with a Rubik cube, and then they had some magazines lying around, and they didn't give any very strict instructions. They just said, have a go with this, see what you make of it. The ones who were just left to do that stayed at it and enjoyed it, reported enjoying doing it more, if they were not offered any kind of financial inducement. The ones who were given a financial inducement to solve the problem enjoyed it much less and gave up sooner, were extrinsically motivated. And it's a very, very simple illustration. There are many, many other studies, experimental and other, which show the same thing, that basically if people are doing things to please parents, to please teachers, to get money, they are less well motivated than people who are doing it because they find it interesting, something that employers just seem to have managed to completely ignore. And what's happening there is a shift in that experiment from, if you like, being, or what has been called flow, being in the experience of my children, of being absorbed and fascinated and challenged and stimulated by something, to having. The famous title of Eric Fromm, the Frankfurt School psychoanalyst, Buddhist, Marxist book, to have or to be, was the question he asked. What a good question. And you move from being to having if you are in the experimental condition where there is a financial inducement to solve the Rubik cube. You move also from satisfying real needs, because we have a real need to be alive, to live in the present, all these things, to wants, confected wants, wants confected by advertisers. I'm going to leave it, obviously, to later speakers who are more expert and specialised than me to talk about many of the aspects that I have covered. Like the sexualisation issue, the subjects that we're going to come on to. I want to focus for a moment on education. Is a particular pet subject of mine and particularly obsesses me. It horrifies me the way that New Labour recycled, and of course is now recycled still, that education is regarded as being for the purpose of creating a successful economy and for achieving economic growth. And as I will come on to later, I don't think economic growth is... underpinning everything is the idea that we must have more and more economic growth, which I want to challenge towards the end. and in the name of that, we had the New Labour creating the kind of target-driven. So first of all, at the first level, the teachers were all turned into extrinsically... there was as much effort as possible to make teachers extrinsically motivated, and their very pay, level of pay, was contingent on the results of their children, of their pupils. We had direct introduction of a direct, straightforward, direct marketing to children on the books that the children read from. So, you know, books as provided by Tesco's, as provided by, continuous attempt to try and infect schools with logos from corporations was completely accepted by Blatcherism, culminating in the actual allowing Tesco's to set the exams, and so the education system was turned really from being what I personally think it should be, which is an attempt to try and help children to find out what interests them and pursue it, if you like, scholarly or not, into an education system which was really an extension of the human resources departments of corporations, an obsession with results, and trying to just categorise which are the sheep and which are the goats, and which are the ones that we're going to pay ludicrous multiples to, and which are the ones we're going to have at the bottom of the pyramid, the huge, great, wide bottom of the pyramid. That was really what was being done to the education system. And increasingly, we saw with the culmination of that, of course, was towards the end of Blatcher's time, was the introduction of academies, which, of course, have been embraced by the present government, and the breaking up of the education system is now well underway, along with the attempt to break up the health system. And I think that the best way to to really focus the disastrous consequences of that process is with the extraordinary evidence regarding the amount of mental illness amongst 15-year-old girls from the top social class. Now, they ought to be, as a generation, you know, as a cohort, they are the most privileged women or females in the history of the world. I mean, their freedoms are unprecedented. There's never been a time in history where 15-year-old girls have had more opportunity. And obviously, girls from the social class one have the greatest opportunity. But if you read the studies by West and Sweeting, where they looked at really good-sized groups and did it really thorough work, very well constructed, they looked at samples of 2,000 15-year-olds in 1995, then again in 2001, and then again in 2007. And they found that right at the outset, the girls in social class one were the most emotionally disturbed. 24% of them were depressed or anxious. This had risen between 95 and 2001 to 38% in just that period between 95 and 2001. And then it rose again between 2001 and 2007 to 44%. 44% of girls from social class one and two. Incredible. And why? Well, they looked into that, and it was a very significant part of that was their feeling, but was essentially that they were extremely extrinsically motivated. They were obsessed with their day-to-day school performance and with their as they even showed that the prevalence of the mental illness went up as they got closer to exams. And, of course, also, they were very preoccupied with their bodies, that the more that they were preoccupied with their bodies and with the exams, the more they were likely to be suffering. Horrifyingly, though, when West and Sweeting did the study again in 2007, they found that the girls in social class 4 and 5 were catching up. They were not far off as high a prevalence of mental illness in the social class 4 and 5 girls as the social class 1 and 2. Now, I've communicated with them about this, and we've discussed what could explain that. And, of course, that was the period when we had, Big Brother had come along, the It Could Be You for a teenage girl in which you could dream at least about being in a reality television had come along, you could have the fantasy that you were going to become one of those unfortunate women who ends up in the tabloids and perhaps having your biography published and perhaps making a million or so. Very, very unlikely. It's about as unlikely as the lottery, but possible. Incredibly, that was the period when the fantasy of fame became more available to girls of that age. And, of course, it was also the period where Ladette culture took off, something that is very much a product of marketing and consumer society. There is a, this is going to be spoken about later on, but I think that, and of course, I think one has to be wary of the young people today position here. I think there is a lot of very healthy, I've just been writing a book about office politics, and I've interviewed quite a lot of young women in their 20s and 30s, and they seem in many ways immeasurably better off than women 10 years, 20 years older than them. They seem to have extremely amusing and interesting sex lives, for example. office politics, sex is very interesting. There are all sorts of ways. I don't want to be standing here saying, God, isn't it disgusting that blah, blah, blah. But I think there have been some awful ways in which the feminism of my generation, which was about at least as much about men changing as about women changing, it certainly wasn't about women becoming men in skirts. Becoming just aggressive, nasty, Sex in the City, vile, what I would call the corporate American female executive type of feminism, I find utterly repulsive, and just as repulsive as the male equivalent. It's just men. It's just what everybody was saying was wrong with men. But I think that is a very clever way in which they have. It's an astonishing irony, which is going to be touched on later, that during a period in which we're supposed to have seen the triumph of feminism, women, particularly young women, have become particularly obsessed with their physical appearance. The solutions, which clearly we need to, it's not enough to just be standing here. All of us bemoaning these things, we're all likely to, sort of broadly speaking, be in sympathy with each other on these matters. I think the solutions, I am going to speak at a very broad level, because I think other people will come to more precise answers. There are specific things that I've long advocated. One would certainly be that advertising should be very, very tightly controlled, completely, and it really is possible for us to have an advertising authority who would insist that no advertisement can show a more than averagely attractive person associated with a product. The end of models in advertising could easily be implemented and would be fantastic. There's nothing to stop that happening. And it would have a significant effect. There's a really good body of scientific literature, which I wrote about in 1997 in a book I published then. I described, even in 97, there was something like 40 or 50 studies that showed that if you sit a whole lot of women down in a room and show them pictures of potted plants and measure how they feel before and after, there's not much change, apart from they might be a bit bored. If you show them pictures of models, they feel considerably depressed compared with how they felt before they'd seen the models. Whereas if you show their boy, could do the same thing with their boyfriends, the boyfriends feel more dissatisfied with the looks of their partners after seeing the models, and even say they love them less. that was known in 1997. I mean, how much research do we need in order to do something about advertising? And also another very practical, simple thing that I proposed in 2002 in another book, is the simple matter of introducing it. I mean, I'm not particularly a fan of Dawkins. I'm not particularly against religion, but I would like to see the time that is used for PSHE and so on used actually to get down to one-on-one therapy. I'd like to see a lot of the resources that go into that actually directed to providing something, and I'm very open to debate about exactly what it would be, but at least six, perhaps as many as 16 sessions of individual cognitive analytic therapy type of therapy or transactional analytic type therapy, or something that would help all 16-year-olds to have gone through the experience of had a good think about where they come from. Because the Human Genome Project is proving, and this is one of the best-kept scientific secrets, which I've actually publishing a book about in a year's time, but it's an astonishing fact that the Human Genome Project is showing that only about 5 to 10% of the difference between your offspring or your siblings is caused by genes. It is really proving that almost without a shadow of a doubt, which if you talk to molecular, I mean, what I've just said is a fact in the sense that it is uncontested by molecular geneticists that so far is what the Human Genome Project has shown. Genes play a very, very marginal effect on your intelligence, your personality, your proneness to mental illness. That is so far the evidence, and actually is what is, that's it. That is actually going to be the final story. It's going to be accepted. So if that's true, you know, that creates a huge, you know, it's hard to get your head around. It's so incredible. It's way more of a role for the environment than I would have predicted. And it suggests, of course, the possibility of great change. So I would say in schools, I want to see, you know, individual care, individual therapy for everybody. Everybody getting a chance to work out where they come from in terms of their family. And, of course, as part of that would be an attempt to try and help them to think, to challenge the brainwashing that they've been subjected to from the wider society through consumption. But in the end, what is going to have to be changed is very, very fundamental. The present ruling elite, they are so far removed from reality that it is, I think, unsustainable. I just don't see. I actually am quite optimistic about. I mean, I think the more bonkers and far away they get from what is reality and what most people are feeling, the better, in a way, because there's going to be a point at which we in inverted commas are not going to put up with it. And everybody says, "Oh, isn't it wonderful, the Arab Spring? Isn't it lovely to see all these people suddenly having, you know, concern with democracy?" Where's our democracy? You know, where is there anybody we can vote for? You know, we have no democracy. There will be an Arab Spring kind of situation here, I think, or something's very, very hard to predict how it'll happen. But a radical, radical change has got to come. And you know, we can change it through culture. Yes, we can try and do our best to influence the culture, but the media is ultimately controlled by Rothermere and Murdoch and so on, and it'll always be limited what we can achieve. To get the sort of situation you have in Denmark takes 60 years. In Denmark, retailers have learned that there is no point in releasing an iPad or the latest exciting gizmo, the iPhone, until everyone can afford it. They actually just don't bother trying anymore to market those things in Copenhagen or in Denmark, because nobody will buy it. Because it is not just a case of, you know, we don't want to seem different. It's a case of you will be stigmatized if you go around showing off through your brands, through your possessions in Denmark. You will actually be unpopular. Well, to get a culture like that takes a long time. It takes, you know, many years. But I think that in terms of the big picture, in terms of what's going to happen in the next, and I'm going to talk here about anywhere, it's anywhere between 1 and 50 years. I could put it as broad as that. If East Anglia disappears underwater in a year's time because of climate change, you can expect some big changes. I feel no animus towards East Anglia, but in many ways I wish it would happen, though, because I do think the planet, from what I'm not an expert on this, but I know some people who are, and I'm extremely concerned about this. You know, if the argument that we have today about consumption and my arguments against materialism is overlap very strongly with the arguments about the future of the planet. And I think about the only safe prediction that you can make is that sometime in the next 1 to 50 years, it will become very suddenly the new orthodoxy that zero or near zero growth is a good thing. That people will actually get to the end of the fiscal year and say, thank God for that. I didn't spend any more money than last year. Thank God I didn't. Thank God our national wealth has not increased by more than that, because we have, that means the planet is more likely to survive. That will be the new orthodoxy, believe it or not. And out of that comes, you move towards a completely different society. You have a redistribution of work in which both parents are looking after the children when they're very small. We stop working the longest hours in Europe. We move towards a much more equal society, a redistribution of wealth, blah, 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 blah. We know all the stuff. And I think that's going to happen. I really do. I think there's a very significant chance that that will come to pass. There is nobody in Parliament today. There are one or two individuals who are sort of saying some of those things, but we're miles away from it in terms of, if you look to the ruling elite, they're not there. But it'll come. It'll evolve. I'm quite sure of it. And I have a feeling that what we are trying to move towards as a society and as individuals is emotional health. That, well, by which I define as being not happiness. I don't buy into the happiness, happy-clappy stuff. What I'm interested in is the idea of something that is sustainable and real, as opposed to positive psychology stuff, which is really just to do with marketing, actually, and very much part of the problem rather than part of the solution. The solution is a population of people who are living in the present and having first-hand experience. It's the first defining feature of emotional health. Secondly, insightful. That is, you can see yourself about to say, make the same mistake again and not make that mistake, which is what you get, hopefully, from therapy. Well, God knows a lot of therapy doesn't help. But thirdly, fluid two-way communication, where you're not jammed on transmit like someone on coke, nor are you jammed on receive like someone who's depressed. But you're able to assert yourself when you've got something to say, but you're able to listen to what other people have got to say. That fluid two-way, I think it's a very rare... Think how many people you know who are first-hand, living in the present, insightful, two-way communication. And then playful, but not game-playing, vivacious, but not hyperactive, and authentic, but not Tony Blair sincere, which means... I felt that it was right to go into Iraq, as though that is an explanation, as though that's American, that is sincerity. Authenticity is something that's quite different, which, thank God, Britain still has some interest in that. We still do have some of these. Our culture hasn't been completely destroyed. What I'm suggesting to you is that we can, as individuals, all work towards that, and God knows it's a struggle, but we can try. It's not in your genes. So it is possible. That still doesn't mean it's easy. And as a society, I honestly think that massive change for the better, as well as the worse, can happen. Yes, we've had, but, and the reason I say that, let's not forget, Thatcherism happened. It was unbelievable for those of us old enough to remember. I can remember when I left university in 1976, everyone wanted to be a social worker or a university lecturer. Nobody wanted to go and work in the city. It was an embarrassing idea. And Thatcherism changed that. It's a radical shift. So if that can happen, so can the opposite. You can have the opposite of Thatcherism. Likewise, the end of the Soviet Union. I still can't get my head around the fact that that happened. We've had, in recent years, they've just kept on coming. You know, you've had the Arab Spring, we've got the Leveson inquiry. You're just rubbing your eyes and ears. You can't believe this is happening. If those things can happen, massive, massive change can happen for the better. And I think, you know, in the end, as I say, let's not despair about young people today and the idea that their brains have all just been rotted. I don't think it is quite as simple as that. Indeed, as I'm sure many of you do meet young, I meet plenty of young people, and I'm sure there are millions of young people out there who are full of optimism, full of really good ideas, and who are absolutely sick to the back teeth of the society they're in. Thanks very much.